afternoon, Troopadors, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 15, with Michael Rack from the Dutty Moonshine Big Band. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I say these guys are probably one of the biggest independent bands in the UK right now. They tour all around Europe, they play to massive crowds, and at the time that we did this interview, they were in the top 10 iTunes chart. They're based in Bristol. I think they're all from Bristol, or down that neck of the woods anyway. And what's especially interesting about this interview is, Michael gives a really good insight into how to make it as an independent artist. He shares tips, secrets, and explains all the hard work and the reality, the mechanics behind it all. So even if you don't know the band, which you should definitely check out just now, they're a festival favourite of mine that always get the crowd going crazy dancing. You're going to learn something today. Behind the smoking mirrors of the music industry, a modern day account of touring, social media, and how his band have been so successful. And like, once again, like the last couple of episodes, this was recorded a few months back now, I think October or November, if memory serves me right. But everything is still relevant, or perhaps even more relevant than it was then. So yeah, it's a really interesting one. I'm really glad that this is getting released on the audio podcast pipeline. Thanks to Mackle for mixing and mastering it. Now, as always, there is no adverts on our show, there is no sponsors, and there is no funding. It's powered purely by our patrons. So if you think you can afford £3 per month and you enjoy this content, then please do sign up to Patreon at patreon.com/youcallthatradio, and you'll get bonus content and freebies, discounts. We do the best we can to make it valuable for you, and you're just doing a good thing as well. It helps support the audio podcast, the YouTube channel, the events that we do, the festivals that we take over. So thank you to the patrons that do support us, and this is in the meantime. I hope you enjoy this chat with Dutty Moonshine Big Band, coming to a city or festival near you soon. Enjoy. Afternoon, Troubadours, Season 3, Episode 16. It's the end of season finale. Now, how do you finish a season in the podcast world? Especially when you're already started working on Season 4. Well, I've been thinking about this for a long time. This is why I haven't released anything. I didn't release anything for ages, because I was like, how do we do this? And I've got it. What you do is you release one of the biggest guests we have ever had, Gordon Raphael. Now, this is if you don't know the name, you'll definitely know his music. He produced The Strokes' first two albums. He's worked with the likes of The Libertines, Ian Brown, 808 State, Regina Spektor, The Wild Hearts, the list goes on. And to make it even more interesting, this was recorded in front of a live studio audience at Blitzkrieg Record Shop in the Barras. And I think it's the only time I've interviewed someone in front of a live audience. People have interviewed me, but I think it's the first and last time that I've ever done it. I would like to do You Call That Radio in front of a studio. So we did do, there was the Overheard in the West End podcast, but that was a different thing years ago. But yeah, anyway, Blitzkrieg Record Shop is in the Barras, which is where we did it. It's an amazing record shop. Shouts to Tony for letting us use his space. You have a beautiful home, Tony. and thanks to Lucy, Wordville Publishing. It's a publishing company in London. And Lucy, who I think was one of our very first ever guests on You Call That Radio, she invited me to interview him, which is an honour because he is one of the biggest music producers of our time, a fascinating guy to speak to. I think there's the occasional language barrier, and at one point, he doesn't seem to be too happy that I hadn't read the entire book yet, but I had to be honest when he put me on the spot in front of everyone. Have you even read the book? I was like, no. I was going through a tough time and I didn't have time to read the book before I did the interview. But I have read it since. It's called The World Is Gonna Love This, and I recommend it. Highly recommend that everyone that checks it out. And once again, this is a classic recording. It must be about a year or so old, maybe longer. But the reason this one was never released is not because of me. It's actually because I didn't have permission to release it. I think there was a few things that were maybe didn't want to be public. But I think since then he's done he toured the whole world with this book. And I think he's basically maybe mentioned a few of the stories. I don't know exactly why. All I know is I wasn't allowed to release this. I was told under no circumstances was allowed to release this. And then one day I asked the question and I was given the green light. So I'm delighted and surprised to finally release this one. Some amazing tales of the rock and roll lifestyle and producing groundbreaking music with international superstars. Now, remember, we have no sponsors, no funding and no adverts. So if you want to support what we do, then go to patreon.com/ you call that radio. For £3 a month, you can join the Mincing Ties crew and help us build the thing. And I want to thank all the patrons who do support what we do. This show is only possible because of you. Now, we also upload a lot more regularly to YouTube. It's youtube.com/ you call that radio. And if you enjoy this interview, if you really enjoy this interview, you can go into YouTube and type in Gordon Raphael, you call that radio Q&A, because there's an actual question and answer session at the end that I've cut off. So it's just going to be me and Gordon speaking. But if you want some bonus content, there is a Q&A that I've uploaded to you call that radio's YouTube channel. All the links will be attached to this podcast somewhere if you look. I don't know where you get your podcasts from, but look where you got it from. There should be info in there. Notes. Is that what it's called? Stream notes? Liner notes? I don't know. It's been a long day, guys. I hope you enjoy this. I hope you enjoy this. I want to thank Mako for mixing and mastering the audio and Delboy Mackay for recording it in the first place. Next time we go back to the future and we will be in 2024 where we will kick off season 4. But for now, right now, this is the last interview of season 3. It's a big deal. It's Gordon Raphael of the Strokes and the Libertines fame. And it's recorded live at the Blitzkrieg Record Shop in the bar, is in front of a live studio audience. Enjoy!
What was that?
This is a democracy when you call that radio. 3, 2, 1.
Hello, my little Glasgow chums. My name is Lucy George, and although I have some friends in the audience who know me as other names, that is my real name. And I am what I call the mayor of Wordville, which is a publishing company. I'm very happy to have some Wordville authors in the house, as they say. Joe Dark has a book published in Guidebill. It's great. Pointy Bull over there has a book poetry published in Guidebill. So we're trying to look for books about people that have changed the industry, whatever art form they worked in. We're only really interested in books about the performing arts, because that's the thing I'm interested in most. And so Gordon, it's fair to say, has completely changed the music landscape by the work he did with the Strokes, but also with a multiple decades long career with the people he's worked with. And you'll see in the book the influence that he's had just for this particular style. I don't know enormous about, I'm a lot about music. Anyone who's seen me on stage recognises that fact. But what I do recognise in working with Gordon is the precision and the care and the generosity of the man. And he's really interested in the end result. And I think that there's something about that that really appears in this book. So I have purposely invited Mark McGee to interview him. And the reason is because I think Mark McGee epitomizes the Glasgow music scene.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. I met Mark probably on stage in a festival where he everything went wrong and he had to fill for time. And he said one of the most hilarious lines. And this young man, right, it was good. I told you this a couple of times. It was so good. So he was sort of saying, "Oh, Jeremy Clarkson, he's Nigel Farage on wheels." And as soon as he came up and said that, I don't know what he then went on to say, but I just thought, this man is extraordinary. And I've been following his career ever since. And obviously I know Joe anyway, because we played together. But I thought Mark is the perfect person because he understands music. He's the heart of this city. So I'm going to pass you over to Mark to interview the legendary music producer. It's
Thank you very much, Lucy. The world is going to love this. And the world did. When did you realise that the world was loving it?
The first thing that happened was I opened a copy of NME magazine, and there's these kids that I just made a demo for, and the picture is in NME. And living in New York, when anything went in NME, it was like a big fucking deal. So I was like, whoa, this is unusual.
And how did you meet the Strokes?
I had a band called Absinthe, and we found a young person who was doing bookings, like they were throwing parties. Her name was Carrie Black, and we wanted to see what kind of parties she threw. She invited us to Lunar Lounge on Ludlow Street, and there were two bands playing. The first band I loved, they were called Come On. The second band had a lot of style, but I didn't really get it, and they were called The Strokes. And I had a little blue business card from my studio, and I was kind of only been a couple years in New York at that time, and I needed to work as often as I could to keep my rents paid. So I went to both bands and said, "I have a studio two blocks away. I make really good demos cheap. Come visit us, you'll like it." And the first band that I really liked, they didn't call me. And the second band, which I thought was okay, they came and visited and made a demo, and that was The Strokes.
The Strokes. At what point did you go, we know that the NME, so for people that are a bit younger, I was at the right age where I read the NME. I think I was maybe 15 when this was all happening. So, you know, the NME was a Bible, and I mean, it was really important because it's not like it is now where you can actually just listen to the song yourself. Yeah. You had to find it. And I remember hearing the buzz of The Strokes, and before I'd actually heard the song, and then I think it was last night, just came out, and as soon as I heard it, I was like, that is the new sound. And I think everybody, does everyone remember hearing last night for the first time? And it was an incredible buzz. And so at what point, so I understand that you moved to the UK because of the buzz, at what point does that happen?
After I recorded Is This It, I got actually invited by the Libertines to come work with them. So I came, and when I saw the reaction that was happening in London, specifically where I landed on The Strokes, and they put a picture of me on their album, which is very unusual, and got me into a lot of parties and a lot of different recording studios. And as soon as I felt the love that was happening, and it was, US didn't catch on for a couple of years. So this was like, I'm going to this place where they already love this music that I've made. And that's why I moved to London.
So New York was still at that point, New York was just not, was it a small scene that was loving it, or was it just getting
more? Some people who knew the downtown music scene were, you know, had read in NME, and they, you know, very few people actually like were going to the magazine shop to get NME. There was only a, you know, certain kind of nerdy rock person like me. Would go to the magazine shop near my studio every week and see what NME was saying. And so, yeah, it was. There wasn't really much going on in New York at the time or in the US, but it was all kicking off in the UK, big time.
And it's easy. It's a bit easier to break the UK because you can just play a bunch of cities and feel that love straight away. And when you were, you're in Libertines, you mentioned there. So I go back to that. How did you meet Pete Doherty?
There was a Stroke show. The biggest show they played was around June when Hard to Explain came out. They played at Heaven London. And I went to that show to see, I went from New York to London to see that show because I thought when that single comes out, there might be some palpable buzz in the air. Like I might be able to see the city reacting to the song. I just felt like it would happen. And it really did. So I went to the Heaven London show, and there was an after party, and I was sat by myself at a back table, just looking at all these people, thinking, these are the people I want to meet. You know, they're like the in-the-know music scene of London right now, and this is exciting. And there was a woman at the table next to me, and she said, "Are you Gordon?" Sorry about that. Yeah, like, how do you know? I thought, how do they know me? Like, the album's not out with my picture. And she said, "This is Pete, and he's got a band called The Libertines, and I'm managing them, and we'd love you to record them." And I thought, oh, that's cool. After, you know, one show, my first day in London, I'm getting a job offer. And they gave me a CD, and I was going to Mallorca for the summer to go holiday with my friends there. I just wanted a whole summer away from New York City and at the beach and getting sun and being in Europe. And I played this CD they gave me, this demo, and it was kind of like this, what I could only describe as some kind of semi-traditional British folk music with acoustic instruments and like, like this kind of, and I thought, well, it's kind of cool, but I don't think I'd be the right producer for this kind of music. And I went to an internet cafe, that's what we did back in those days, and I wrote, her name is Banny. I said, "Banny, I listened to that demo you gave me, and it sounds cool as it is. I don't really know what I would contribute to that, but, you know, thanks for the offer." I said no. And then I had an opportunity to go back to London a little while later, and suddenly they had changed to an electric band, and they were fucking good. And they were, like, jaw-dropping good.
Just going to see what happened to the Libertines. Shit.
I said yes the second time. Yeah.
And what was the second time? What was it you worked on with the Libertines?
Well, they asked me, even when they were in that acoustic phase, they said, "Will you be our producer?" And I said, no. And then when they played me, they actually saw a rehearsal, because I didn't even like the next electric demos. I thought they sounded horrible too. But Banny convinced me, like, before you give up on this group, come see a rehearsal. And I thought, I don't know why I'm saying yes, but it's because you're nice enough to let me stay at your house. Okay, yeah, it would be rude not to. So I go in there without any high hopes, and they played right in front of me in a room about between me and John Zip over there. Like, the room was this big at Rue's studio, and they were set up in a line, and I was in a chair, and they gave me a bag full of marijuana and some tobacco and rolling papers, which made me like them very much before they even played. And then they started playing one song after the other, and I was like, oh my God, I just met the Beatles at 18 years old, maybe 18-year-old Beatles, and this is going to be the greatest, you know, British rock band. Everyone's going to love them, and I got to work with them. And I said, is there paper and pen? Yes. And I started just writing notes about what I was going to do and how we're going to produce it. And then they asked me to go on a tour with them to be their live sound man, and so I get to know the music better. And long story short, I didn't record them at all, but I had some adventures, and I wound up living in London for a couple of years because of that situation.
Amazing. And how long did you spend in the UK altogether, did you say that?
I moved in early 2002, and I left for Berlin in 2005. So there was a three-year thing going on.
Did Berlin start getting cooler? I think that's about the time Berlin got cooler.
It got actually, like, as soon as I moved there, it started getting less cool. But then, in my opinion, and I hope nobody takes offense, so did London, actually. Yeah. Because very quickly, the whole circle around the Libertines kind of, like, changed, and then the music industry was pumping lots of money in to get people to wear skinny jeans and Converse, but make really slick, radio-friendly music. And I didn't want to work on that kind of stuff. And it was turned into a big money industry, and I kind of lost interest. But for a couple of years, it was really vital.
It's interesting you say about radio-friendly music, because what you have always, the records that I've heard you do sound unique and interesting, yet they can still get played on the radio. How do you do that one?
Only occasionally, like maybe, you know, even on, maybe on Is This It, what was there, two songs that may be hard to explain, and last night they were on the radio.
Someday?
Maybe, yeah.
Definitely.
I think that those guys were so clever. You know, their songwriting is so infectious that, like, they crossed over a lot of boundaries, making a weird sound. And even their American label was telling me that this is a sound that no one will buy. Like, this is so, you're ruining their music with this horrible production. They were saying that, literally. But their music was so strong that even with horrible production, it just, you know, cut through.
It is no horrible production. What's a horrible production? No, it was fantastic, fantastic production. And they were wrong. And you had the last laugh in that one. And what about can we bring up Damon Albarn? I heard you that running with Damon Albarn. What's that? Damon Albarn, I heard.
Yeah, but what did you see?
I heard there was a bit of a running.
Oh yeah, that's
it. Lee's one of the funniest stories in
Can you hear it?
Lucy, am I allowed to tell the Damon Albarn story? Okay.
You can tell this. This is not streamed live. You can tell it.
It's a bit long-winded, though. I don't know how to tell a short version.
Tony, we've got time. Show us to Tony. I'm going to look at you. Red Cross Rogers, a beautiful home. A beautiful home.
By the big.
Can't tell him what it is, I'm saying.
So this is album two with the Strokes, Rhythm on Fire. And we've been working really hard almost all summer. And we're in New York recording the second record, and at Madison Square Garden, Blur was having a reunion show after, you know, years of not playing together. And the Strokes were excited to go see Blur play at Madison Square Garden, and I decided I don't really want to see that. I'll just stay here in the studio and work on editing and moving snare drums and, like, just smoking more marijuana or something. And then about maybe 12:30, little after midnight, I hear rumbling coming up the stairs, and it's the Strokes, and they brought back Damon Albarn. And they're all in various stages of alcohol intoxication, some worse than others. And I'm going to really tell this. Okay, Damon Albarn came right into the studio and sat right next to me on the couch, and then they said, "Hey, Gordon," this is, and the Strokes go like, "Hey, Gordon, this is Damon from the Blur." I go, "Hi, nice to meet you." And he says,
"Cut life!"
Looks at me, says, "David Bowie calls me on the phone every day." I thought, well, that's cool, but whoop-de-doo, and what a weird opening line. But you don't have to earn my, I'm just like a producer guy, you don't have to earn my respect with that. So I didn't give him that much of a reaction. I was like, "Oh, wow, cool." And then he goes, since he saw that didn't land too well, he goes, "You know, I'm one of the only people who can actually sing all the Beatles harmonies, all the parts."
Oh, God. Yeah. See all the people.
Whoa, in my mind, I say strike two. Whoa, what is this all about? And so then Julianne says, like, "Hey, Gordon, we really want to play some of these songs that we're working on for Damon to see what he thinks." And I think, man, we have a little bit of work to do tonight. Do we really have to do this? But I play a song, and the Strokes are kind of looking worried. They're like looking sad and worried and looking at Damon's reaction. And Damon's like, "Okay." Play two songs. Damon's is like, "Yeah, I can see how you're going to have a really hard time selling this." So I'm like, "Fuck you, man. This shit sounds so good." And I've seen the Strokes get worrier by the minute, like, "Oh no, I thought so. We thought the same thing." And we, you know, it's hard doing a second album, you know? And so Damon and Julian talk for a minute, and all of a sudden, Julian, "Gordon, Damon suggests that we need some harmonies on the song. That's going to really help them. And he's offered to do some harmonies." So would you set up a microphone for him and record him doing some harmonies? And I'm thinking, Strokes with harmonies? Jesus Christ. That's what I liked about you guys. You don't have tambourines. You don't have shakers. You don't have doubles. You don't have acoustic guitar playing gently in the background. You just play your music. "Hello, okay, yes, Julian, you're my boss, for sure. Here, set up a microphone." And Damon goes out, at least got some lyrics in front. He tries a few things, and he's like, and everything he's done, like, makes me feel physically ill. And I said, this sounds so awful. And he's like, he kind of knows that it doesn't sound good. He's like, hey, no, never mind that one. I have a different idea. So when he said, never mind that one, I would just, like, mute the channel that he had already, I wouldn't erase it. I would just keep it, but mute it just in case they wanted to listen to it back later or whatever. And he tried another idea, and he tried another idea, and hey, he probably worked for like an hour putting in lots of ideas. And at the end he said, you know what? This music doesn't need harmonies. You know, it's just, it's fine. And I don't think I like any of my ideas. So he comes in the studio and Julian goes, Gordo, would you play back some of that stuff that he did? And I had an evil intention and an evil action, which was, you know, if I were to play back each idea a little at a time, maybe it would have sounded half okay. But instead, I kind of looked around slyly and I unmuted like 12 different ideas that had nothing to do with each other. And said, like, no, you want to hear it? Okay, here. And this chorus of cacophonous, out of tune, bad ideas just happened at once. And everyone looked really worried. And Julian said, no, I don't think that's going to work. And he said, may I erase this? I goes, yeah.
No.
There's a part two of this story, but do you want to go on to something more interesting?
Part two,
we're at about 2:30 in the morning, and Damon's tour manager is like looking at like, Damon, we've got to go to Boston, and that's like a 3-hour ride away, and we need to get back to the tour bus. The guys are waiting. And also, one thing that Damon had slipped in earlier in the conversation, you know, I make a lot more money with the Gorillaz. I'm just doing this tour here for the guys. You know, they need a lot, you know. So that was another thing he slipped out. But yeah, his tour manager was like, Damon, we got to get back to the other guys at the Madison Square Garden. The bus is taking off. He goes, I want to stay and party with the Stroll. I want to drink some more beer with Julian. And no, come on, Damon, come on. And he goes, I'll take a taxi to Boston. Damon, that'll be hundreds of dollars. You can't do it. I think the last thing was him being like kind of let out, sadly, out of her building. I plunge right now where it's going. I don't have any other words.
Well, one day, maybe a part three. That was brilliant. And I love the way that you called him Damien at some points as well. Let's talk about people that you do like working with. We know you've dealt with Truth Inspector. I'd like to hear about how you met her. So, let's just go to Truth Inspector, actually. Yeah. I heard this. How did you meet? It was a strange one.
That's actually where the book title comes from, to be honest. I got a call from a friend of mine that I'd worked with several times in New York while I was living in London. He goes, hey, Gordon, you coming to New York anytime soon? I go, yeah, it's like Christmas coming up. I actually have a flight in a couple days. I'm going to go to New York for Christmas. He goes, great. I have a really great artist named Regina, and we would like you to record. I said, no, I've been working all year really hard, and I'm just going to party in New York. I'm going to just do nothing but party and have fun. I'm not working at all. He goes, oh, okay. Well, she's like 23 years old, Russian girl, plays piano really well. 23-year-old Russian girl plays piano really well. I'll meet her, but I'm not working. And he goes, okay, meet us this time. So I go to this recording studio, and I'm talking to my friend, and Regina comes in, and she's wearing this really mishmash, thrift shop, kind of indie fashion things. She put together, like, scarves and hats and, like, things and pins and big fluffy sweaters and more scarves. And I know, oh, very interesting. Curly red hair, like, really thick red hair. And I shake her hand. I said, hi, nice to meet you. What do you do? She goes, Alan, is this piano okay if I use it? Okay. So she sits down at the piano and pulls up her thing, and she pulls a chair over, and she gets a drumstick out of her purse, and she starts like whamming the chair with her drumstick like horses galloping, and she's playing like classical music with her left hand. I'm like, shit. And then she's looking right up at my face, like singing these lyrics and these melodies that are blowing my mind. Mm. Like, and within basically 20 seconds, I'm thinking, the world is going to love this. I have to record it. And I imagined how I was going to record it while she was playing the first song. And when it was over, I said, Alan, is the studio available now? And I go, yeah. And I said, okay, go get me 11 microphones. And he looked at me like, there's a girl playing the piano and singing. Why do you need 11 microphones? Just go get me 11 microphones. And I made an elaborate arrangement with like two microphones on the piano, a mic on her voice, a mic on the drumstick hitting the chair, a mic in the air that captured just the blend of it, another mic in the air that I ran into a Fender guitar amp with another mic in front of it down the hall so that it would be like a room with a girl playing a piano going through an amplifier, being microphoned into the recording desk, things like that. And within maybe 20 minutes, we had Poor Little Rich Boy recorded, which we thought was just going to be like an EP we're going to make, but wound up being on the album, the very same thing. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
She blew my mind. She completely floored me with her. Every moment with her in the studio was a revelation. Absolutely.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And another part of the book that I love is Ian Brown.
Have you read the book?
I've read most of the
just the highlighted bits.
No, yeah, well, my team read it.
Oh, that's good. And they fed you the one liners.
I've got script writers for that.
Okay.
It's quite obvious that there's no script writers for my one liners. Let's be honest. No, I've read most of the book.
That's honest.
I'll be honest. How honest will I be? Will I tell you what's been going on the last 2 weeks in my life? No,
we'll move on. He's missing more about me than it is about me.
It's not all about me. I forgot. It's not all about me. I would like to ask you about Ian Brown.
Ian, best story.
It's a great story.
It's the opposite story of the Damon story.
That's what I was going to do to then. I got distracted by Regina Spektor, but from Damon to Ian Brown.
Yeah, okay. So, first of all, I was living in a transient hotel in Los Angeles. I wasn't exactly transient because the boss of the hotel gave me the room because he said we're going to do a bunch of heavy-duty television advertising. He's going to give me lots of money. He never did, but I had this little room in the hotel, and someone had given me like the Sounds of Manchester cassette right when it came out. It was actually called that, and had In Spiral Carpets, Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, and a few others. And I loved it because I play keyboards and I like organ, and this music was like this danceable rock with this organ featured on everything, and I just thought it was so damn cool. Okay, fast forward 10 years, I guess. I'm in New York, and maybe more. And I get a call during a lunch break. I was working on my own music. I get a call during my lunch break. Some guy with a British accent asking if this was a recording studio. And I thought it was weird because I didn't know that our studio was even in the phone book. So it never happened that I picked up the phone and it was someone wanted to record. And I said, yeah. He said, can I come over and record something real quick? I thought, man, I'm working on my own stuff right now, but you know, maybe I could use another $25, right? You know, that would help me with my cause from living in New York. So I said, what do you want to do? So I just want to do some vocals. I said, okay. And I gave him the address of the studio, and he said his name was Ian. And so I thought, I want to get him out of here quick. He's just doing one vocal. I imagine it'll be like an hour, and I'll get $25. So while he was coming over, I made a little Logic session that said Ian's song, and I sat at my computer and I set up a really good microphone in the other room, and I just waited for him to come. But I also thought, man, he said he lived in the neighborhood. Maybe he's a drug addict. He's coming to just steal my equipment. You know, I better keep my eye open here. This East Village, and you know, it was unusual that someone was going to come that I didn't know or hadn't met. So he comes downstairs. And this guy Ian, he's kind of a bit of a rocker, like a shag haircut and a nice leather jacket. And he had a really beautiful girl with a poncho, like a South American poncho on. And he said, hi, I'm Ian, and this is Fabiola. And I said hello to both of them. And he walked through my little studio, and it only had red lights or something. And he said, like, it's a bit like a massage parlor, yeah? Yeah, massage parlor, he said. I said, oh, yeah, it's nice. So what do you want to do? I have really good microphone out there. You want to sing on that? And he goes, oh no, I want an SM57, which is like, and oh, this guy doesn't know much about music, you know, that's a really good microphone. This is like in every band practice room in the whole world is this microphone.
That one now,
right? Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
So 58. Anyway, so he's standing behind me, and I'm pressing record on Ian's song, and I'm wearing headphones because he wants to be in the same room with me, behind me, and so I had to turn the speakers off so it wouldn't make feedback. And I'm listening to him sing, and I'm like, oh, he's got a really cool voice, actually, this Ian guy. And I thought, wow, like this is like, that was 10 seconds. I'm like, this is a cool voice. 20 seconds into the song, I'm like, I know this voice. This is really familiar to me. And I'm looking, Ian's song, this voice, Ian's song. Oh my God, you're recording Ian Brown from Stone Roses. So he sings this song like perfect one time through. It takes like 5 minutes for him to sing the whole song. And I turn around, are you Ian Brown from Stone Roses? He said, well, I am Ian Brown, but the Stone Roses broke up a few years ago, and I'm just doing this for 808 State. I'm going to go. And I said, how'd you find out about us? He said, I was looking for the closest studio to my apartment because I have to go right now to JFK and fly over there and make this demo. And he said, you're a very good engineer, by the way. How much do I owe you? I said, $25. And he gave me a $50. And walked out and from that, I'm thinking, wow, that's so cool.
Evan, I was actually researching the song with the 808 State collaboration, and it's never been released, has it? Or has it been leaked?
I guess not.
There's a lot of people on the internet talk about it, and some claim to have heard it, but without any proof. And it's just people on the internet, so...
It might happen on a hard drive somewhere. Yeah, so
there is a forum online. They would love to hear it. And I just want to see 808 State next week at Down the Rabbit Hole. So I'm excited to see that. Yeah, is everybody going to Down the Rabbit Hole?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh.
And so with Ian Brown just came in, did it? So you said you were a good engineer. So at what stage did you consider yourself a good engineer at that point?
I had a lot of experience engineering. I did a lot of like basement recordings on 4-track, like for decades, you know, and I really got an arsenal of tricks. But it wasn't until I moved to New York in 1998 that I went into a studio and became a partner where they had good equipment. Like I was always using equipment like this and little mixers like this and a little 4-track and a synth and a guitar plugged directly in. But I managed to make that sound like, I thought I made hundreds of great songs that way. So when I actually got a computer and great preamps and good microphones, I kind of applied the information that I had a little learning curve, learning how to use a computer mostly, and learning the characteristics of good microphones and preamps. But I think by the time he got in there, after the first year I was experimenting, I felt like I really could do cool stuff. Like I could put one microphone in front of a drum kit and had it sound like Massive Attack, like with one mic, like, you know, it's like, oh, man, I think I'm getting it now.
Amazing. So it's good that you had that confidence as well, and obviously it seems like the thread from all success stories is a bit of confidence and also a bit of luck and a bit of serendipity.
Yeah.
And we were talking about that
before. What a combination.
Yes, that is, you need all three, don't you? Or about hard work.
You can't exist without any of those elements.
So what we put that down to? So hard work, luck, serendipity. What was the other one?
Confidence.
Angelic guidance. Oh, sorry.
And angelic guidance. So can you do it with 4 out of 5? How many do you need for it to work?
That's a good question.
Because there's people that work hard that aren't confident that can make it. There's people that are lucky that just are lucky.
Hard work and serendipity. I think you could go with that. And,
So serendipity-wise, what would you say? I mean, when you make bumping into the Strokes?
Yeah. Or having Ian Brown show up.
Or having Ian Brown. Because that must have just made you feel like you only get 50 quid, but you would have felt $1 million just after that.
It was double what I expected. And it was him, and he smiled and said good things, you know, and like that made, and at that time, Even when I met the Strokes, I'd never sold a single record. You know, I wasn't like a guy with lots of records in the shop. I wasn't on the team of experienced record producers. I knew I was good and I had something, but it wasn't verified by the world yet. You know, I hadn't got approval yet.
And I heard, so you're saying Ian Brown, I think you used the phrase one take wonder, because you just came in, did the business and got out.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of other artists that you refer to as a one take wonders that just come in and do it well. I think Skinner was just going to bring, just like to get the transporter ram, because I was struggling to the
German.
So Skunk and Nancy, for everyone knows, round of applause for Skunk and Nancy, one of the greats, and Skinner is an absolute legend. Yeah. So how did you bump into Skinner, and how did that come about?
It was right when I was starting the project of First Impressions of Earth with the Strokes. I got a message from Skin's manager saying, hey, Skin really wants to work with you. And I'd never heard of her. I heard of Skunk and Nancy, but I never really heard their music. And I listened to this demo, and her voice was just phenomenal. It was like jaw-dropping. It was so piercingly clear, yet with plenty of attitude and like power everywhere. And I wrote to the manager and said, I'm so sorry, but I'm just starting an endless process. I have no idea how many years this is going to take making this record with the Strokes. But I really like her, and good luck. So came around the next Christmas, and Skin said, I heard you're coming to London to your studio there. Why don't we meet just for your week of holiday, and we'll record just for fun to see what happens. So she came down, and we did a few songs in a week with her band. And it was really effortless. Like, she just literally, she'd do one take, perfect, double it, perfect, harmony, one take, double it, harmony, harmony, harmony. Everything just like instant and with a big smile. And if she said she liked it on Tuesday, on Wednesday, she didn't come in having an existential crisis that it was actually shite and they have to do it again. Like, it was just everything you want in a recording session. And as it turned out, I got fired from that third album of the Strokes, and I called Skin immediately and said, hey, we can finish that album. And we did. It's her second solo album.
Amazing, amazing. And I'm going to open up to questions quite soon. Was there just anything? Can we just talk about the sack? And just, that's what you distracted me, because I haven't been at that yet. So the Strokes basically get signed. You're the producer. Mm-hmm. And then they tell you to go, basically. What's the story behind that?
Well, the big picture is that when they did the first record, they started it with a different producer, and I was very disappointed, and then I got the job back. The second album, they started it with a different producer, and I was really sad and devastated, and they fired him, and I got my job back. The third album, they started with me, and then after a year, I got fired, and they brought in another producer.
Why did you get fired?
Why did I get fired? I was messing around with one of their wives. No, I don't know where that came from. No, that's not true. I got fired because they met this other engineer who worked with Paul McCartney, and they thought, man, if we get a guy who works with Paul McCartney, we'll be able to sell a lot more albums, and we need a new sound because all these other bands are coming out now. This is in the year 2004-ish, right? Almost 2005. Like, all these bands are coming, dressing like us, sounding like us, and selling 10 times more records. What do they have that we don't have? Maybe it's really super experienced industry producer, like a guy who works with Paul McCartney. And so they wanted to try this mountainous, gigantoid rock and roll sound that I don't even know how to do. And that's what they did. Yeah. And they spent, not here listening, they spent like millions on it. They had the guy who did Nirvana mixing it, and Andy Wallace. And I was really happy when it was like the slowest selling, even beyond, much slower than the ones we did in my basement for a small budget. That made me a little happy.
But you're still pals now. You're going to Transmit tomorrow to see them.
Yeah, I'm going to see him.
Have you been to Transmit before? Have you been to
No.
You would have been to, I seen the Strokes at Tea in the Park. Did you tour with them back then?
No. Well, yeah, yes, I did.
So Tea in the Park used to be in a field.
No, I was there at that Tea in the Park in 2004.
I was there. Okay. I think I gave
Did he have a stookie on? Did he break his leg? Julian?
Yeah. That was somewhere earlier than that. That was in early 2003-ish. But anyway, I was at that Tea in the Park, for sure.
Rock Ness. Were you at the Rock Ness gig?
No. I was at O2 Festival? Yeah, no, Oxygen Festival in Ireland. And the Tea in the Park here.
Yeah,
basically, I'm just trying to name Scottish gigs at the plate that I've been at. So you go, oh, I was there, and the Scottish crowd, the Glasgow crowd, is the best in the world. So if you just say that, people say, it's all the people in Glasgow really want to hear.
But he's not seen Barrowlands yet. I was trying to get him round to see Barrowlands.
Have you not been to the Barrows yet?
No, I've heard about it.
After this, we'll go to the Barrows together. Field trip to the Barrows. It's literally out on the doorstep here. And we've got the circus that is Transmit behind us. And it's been great talking to you, Gordon. I think we're going to open up to the... What's a round of applause for the Gordon here?
Very good.
And we're going to have a questions. So if anyone's got a question, please don't be stepping towards for that camera, because that's where the microphone is. So if anyone's got a question, does that make it more scary?
Come on first.
How
you doing?
Good, yourself?
Brilliant, fantastic, really enjoyed that.
Thank you, I like your yellow submarine.
Yellow submarine, yeah.
It's happening.
Yellow submarine. So it kind of, just what you're talking about with production, and obviously changing, and the technology has obviously got a lot better, right? The technology associated.
Not necessarily better, it's different.
Well, that's my question, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. As technology's improved, how has it changed production and music? That makes sense.
See, I think the best example of that would be this FL Studio software, and the young generation of producers that are using everything in their laptop only to make musical compositions that are like the top hip hop and trap kind of things, and they have singers sing on top of that. So the whole idea about using just a laptop and software to make music is very innovative. It's so creative and cool. But for my job, recording like a drummer and a guitar player playing together in a room, I'm still using old German microphones and British and US preamps and a room and Fender guitars. And it's still very much the same kind of technology, just recording on computer. But it sounds very much the same and it feels the same. Yeah. So it's like there's advantages and definitely breakthroughs on certain levels. And a return to the standard practices all along as well.
Any minutes?
Lucy? I've got a question actually.
Lucy.
So when I think about like music producer, I don't know, I think about someone like Phil Spector, you know what I mean? Who comes into a room and he's got a complete idea of what he's in, the water sound and all this sort of stuff. And you've worked with some really different bands. How are you putting your thumbprint on it, or is it more about listening to what they actually want? How does it work with the kind of ego of the artist versus what you've got, your own personal taste?
Well, a lot of times I don't actually get to meet a band in person until I come off an airplane in Argentina or Brazil or Seattle. Like I'm meeting them for the first time. But we've had discussions about, I've heard some demos, we've discussed how we're going to do it and this and that. So sometimes it takes a few days of me just doing, like recording basically, like, do you like this sound? Do you like this sound? Are we doing the right thing? Like asking them if we're doing the right thing. And then maybe by day five, I'm starting to get a real vision because now I can hear what they're building much clearer than the demos. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes, like in Regina's case, I had an actual vision of 11 microphones and running things in different ways. Like that's not very often that it happens. Most of the time, the main thing on my mind is these people are paying me money and I want to make sure that whatever they want to happen and whatever they have in their mind is what we get to try first. So I think that my biggest, my most common asset as a producer, and I've been fired for this as well because people say, you're not doing very much, you're just pushing some buttons and turning microphones. But a lot of people really appreciate the fact that they have these wacky ideas, even though they're 22 years old or 23 and I'm much older, like they had some ideas they thought could work. And I actually gave them the space to try it without pulling the card. Like, no, we don't need to do that. We're running out of time. That doesn't work. Believe, I don't ever do that. You know, I did it one time. It's in the book, but I learned from that. And people did it to me all the time as a young musician, like, We don't do that in the big studio. That's how you do it at home. And then the music would suffer. So I think my biggest thing is just whatever makes them happy, if they think this is a cool sound and they're all jumping up and down and smiling, then I've turned the right buttons and I'm doing my job properly. That's it, Mace, basically.
I've got a couple for you, but that's all right.
Do it. I like your shirt.
Thank you, man.
What? Oh, you know where this? Gang of Four? That's a Damien Hirst track.
Wow. What's that, a recent album?
Yeah, okay. When Pete Gill died, or Andy Gill died,
right.
They put this album together and they got loads of different bands to record Gang of Four songs.
Oh, that's so cool.
And it's really good.
Yeah. So, I worked with Dave Allen, one of the original bassists.
Oh.
I actually lived with him for a while in California and got signed on his record label.
I was interested very much in reading the book, and I've only got halfway through it.
That's good.
Because I'm a terrible reader.
I
only read music books that you can see from the kind of stuff that I've got in here. Yep. But you seem to be really influenced by British bands.
Good point. That's why I live in England right now.
I just wanted to...
Why?
Why? I mean, and there are a few American bands that really were influential on me.
Was it the prog thing?
The prog thing? I don't know. First it was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, you know, and Led Zeppelin and all that. And then the prog, then as a keyboard player, hearing Rick Wakeman play with Yes, is like, I'm going to grow up and have a circle of synthesizers around me for sure. You know, that's like 15-year-old me was definitely going to be Rick Wakeman.
So you like guitar, but you obviously love the Moog and all that.
I love synthesizers. I like, you know, I like the Stooges and the Velvet Underground, even though the Velvet Underground has viola.
It's cool. I mean, I'm really, really enjoying what I've read the book, and I'm a terrible reader, as
but
I said.
But also, it was...
Actually, on that point, is there an audiobook, plans for an audiobook for terrible readers like myself including?
Yeah, we're working on it. But I want to say that even as a young teenager, it wasn't lost on me that my favorite superhero, Jimi Hendrix, was dying of starvation in New York City until some British guy from The Animals, Chas Chandler, brought him to London. And the next day, he was jamming with Eric Clapton and putting Cream in a fear mode along with Pete Townsend and Jeff Beck. You know, that's because something British happened that allowed that legend to shine. And then, I'm from Seattle, and our little grunge scene would never have been anything if people in the UK didn't think, hey, look, they look like loggers with their little plaid shirt, but they play electric guitar. That is a hoot. Bring them on over. We want to see this. Tad, Mudhoney, you know, it all came, it all became... So it was never lost on me that the UK was a magic watering ground for the music I like.
Halfway through the book, that sings loud for me.
Yeah.
The other question I've got to ask you is, the Strokes worked with, and he worked live, he was the backline guy for all the shows, was a Scottish guy from Govan called Brian Dunn.
I met him 100 times.
And I wanted to ask you.
He was a sweetheart. Yeah, I met him 100 times. He's a really sweet guy.
He's out with Liam Gallagher just now. But from what I hear,
double dating
every single, you done every single Strokes gig, that right up to even the Alba gigs and the Julian gigs, when he done the solo album.
Yeah, I saw him on the Julian tours.
So I didn't know if you had met him. And
he met him. I've hung out with him.
So the real next door came from his brother Brian.
Okay,
and they were directly related to Michael McNeil from Simple Minds.
Okay,
so that's where I got that.
Tony, that's the lawyer question. Sorry, there's people in the questions. I know it's your short. Sorry, I know it's your short, but it's like we can talk after this. But that is a brilliant build to do. That is by Simple Minds. And can we have another round of applause for Tony? Thank you for having us here. You are the man. You are the man. This is a beautiful shot. You're Tony. You can you're next after her.
Gordon,
yes, please stand closer to the mic. Thank you.
How close?
No, just in the middle.
Back a bit.
Just by, but
turn to the left. Yeah, that's
the
line.
Is it the right light?
Yes, play it.
Gordon, so it's a big project to write a book. So what made you decide to write a book?
I always knew that I should write two books. And I would use the first book that features the years of working with the Strokes to sell the second book, which is about my piano lessons and my various synthesizer noodlings. But in secret, I knew I would never write either of these books because if I have 5 minutes of free time, I'm going to be at a coffee shop or walking in a town or looking for new G. I'm not going to sit down and go like, let's see, chapter two, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. That's not me at all. But because of the lockdown, it was me for long enough to get that thing finished.
Yeah, so it was not all bad. COVID's not all bad. But I could book out of it. If it just, can I just, or just before I bring in, can I just to follow up on that? So because it's something that was unfamiliar to you, obviously a very experienced, successful music producer, turning your hand to writing a book, how difficult was it at first?
It wasn't difficult because I also write. I mean, I wrote stories and I wrote lyrics, and writing is something that I've been working on since I was a little kid.
But never
something so thick, you know. But it was really just like a bunch of, this is this story, I can do that. And then what happens next is this story. So it was actually very simple and easy and quite quick to write it. But then I had the editing thing. And here's a very funny story. My best friend is a real book person. And I brought her my book 2 months after I'd written. And it took me 2 months to write it, basically. I said, I got my book finished. She said, your book finished? What do you mean? I said, oh, I'm done. I said, now you have to edit it. And I thought, and in my mind, I thought, she doesn't know that I'm such a good writer. I'm kind of special. I'm kind of gifted, actually. And I'm one of these kind of guys, I don't need editing. And it just comes out right. And so I took my, she wouldn't read it. I took it back to my house a couple days later. I thought, I want to see this thing now. I read it and it's like, endless sentences and paragraphs that would go down the page onto the next one. And every time I stopped to think about what I'm going to say next, I automatically made a comma. So there were like 100,000 commas that just needed to be removed. And long story short, 2 months to write and about 4 to 6 months of over 4 different edits. And then I got, when I got with Lucy and Wordville, 10.
Any other questions? Wordville and Lucy?
Then Ted George said, now we're going to do a little final edit. And his suggestions were phenomenal. It was so cool because I've never worked with an editor and I've never worked with a producer or an engineer before either on my music. I always thought, I don't want to hear what anyone else has to say. So I was a little bit like, my feathers were ruffled. Like, okay, this guy's going to tell me stuff and ask me stuff. Let's see. But it was so cool because he made 100 suggestions, of which all of them were good. I agreed with most of them, and there were a few where I said, this is how I say it. I'm gonna stick to my guns. But there was nothing cheesy. You didn't ask me to do anything cheesy or stupid that made me angry. It's just like, these are very good suggestions, and I'm gonna do this and do this and do this, and these 4 I'm not gonna do because I wanna keep it my way.
Yes, of course.
So it was a great experience, even to the end.
Amazing. Kenny Mulligan is in the house. Kenny, what is your question? Can you move a bit closer to the camera?
Okay, just there,
that's fine, mate. Perfect.
Hi, is it me? You got the
nice one.
Well, you know what? Your history and your experience working with different bands, and not all the bands that you mentioned tonight, I had interaction with them in London in various forms, working from EMI as a journalist and freelancing. And with NME and EMI and some labels all throughout the 30 years being down south. What really strung out for me, stuck out for me tonight, was the your love of British music, especially when you mentioned the early Happy Mondays and the MOOC playing on the indie scene. You know, from an Inspiral Carpet scene and all that sort of thing. And I had an element of like something like the Doors, but we had that sort of indie punk thing around it.
Right.
Do you still feel that there's that's still got a lot of reverence today in today's indie music? I mean, in terms of bands that you want to maybe work with in future, hopefully the Gyro Babies and producing them, you know what I mean? Or Jack O'Tree's Marks bands, or, you know, so, you know, where does your circumference sort of stop this? Is it specifically rock? What is it really magnetise you to the sort of tracks that you, like super bands that you'd really want to work with. And is there a certain, you know, we've all got that pull to certain tracks or certain bands. Have you identified what it exactly is?
Sure, I have, and I totally get your question. There's two things. First of all, the bottom line, it has to be innovative. It can't be like jumping on a sound and a lyric style or a story. And every little element, there's so many elements in music, the beat, the sound, the way they look, their attitude, the way the voice sounds, the emotions. There's so many elements that can be copied or boring or not without great innovation. So I don't like any of that stuff. So I like stuff that's just like, what the hell am I listening to? So that's the first thing. Like, it has to be completely innovative and groundbreaking. And at the same time, this is a really unquantifiable, it just has to hit you like, this is for me. You know, because there could be great music that's innovative that I just goes over my head. I have no, I would never play it again. You know, I won't Shazam it instantly. But I go into a shop all the time, or I'm in a restaurant, like, what the fuck's that? I gotta find out what it is. Oh, everybody be quiet. You know, I love it when I find something that hits me. So it's like the unquantifiable thing that it just speaks right to your heart or to your mind and makes you fascinated.
And this second one, sorry, follow up. Is there any bands in the UK, particularly now you're in Glasgow, you know, there's not just what's happening over there, you know, the really underground sort of, what we say, alternative, you know, scene, you know?
Yeah.
Is there anybody you picked up on that you sort of caught in it? You know, have you time you've had a listen around to what's happening here? Because it's such a thriving, and all, I would say that, I'm, you know, but is there anybody that's caught your eye?
I think we're coming out of maybe a 15 or 20 year period or something where kind of innovative music with guitars and bands and human players has kind of been really relegated. And I think there's a new generation of young people that are really interested in studying piano and voice, like really performing. I think that's coming back. There are several that I've heard that I really like, and one in particular I just recorded last week in Leeds called The Lounge Society. And they're playing with the Strokes today in Lytham. And they're really phenomenal. They're everything. Like, they did six songs in one day because they were so rehearsed and so tight and so on it and enthusiastic. So I think that record is gonna do really well. The Lounge Society.
Actually, on that point, we released a vinyl, Gyro Baby Straight to Utopia, with a small label in England called Grebo Records. And he messaged me when he seen that I was going to be here tonight. He said that we have a common, tenacious link, the 7 degrees of separation, or whatever it is. So also on that same label is a band called Crash Island, and you mix Strange Shores. He said that I should mention that. Do you remember that?
No. Well, it sounds good.
Can
Crash Island?
Crash Island, and this, it was called Strange Shores.
Yeah, I think I do remember the name, but I can't remember if that was during the pandemic or something. It was probably just one song or something.
It was one song. You mixed one song.
Give them as advice,
No, you mixed one song.
Okay.
How many songs have you mixed? An exact number.
3,000. I did 1,000 of my own before I even got into working with other people. So.
Is there any more questions?
Who's
your favourite? Who's your favourite musician of all time?
What a great last question. Who is your favourite musician of all time?
Too many to name, really.
Okay, five. You get five.
Five. I have a pantheon of musicians that
absolutely.
Carrie Muneer, the keyboard player for Gentle Giant, one.
Okay.
Jimi Hendrix, John McLaughlin, this guitar player played with Miles Davis and then went into some spacey rock music. Who else is one of my favorite musicians? Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer. A guy named Michael Narada Walden, who played drums, phenomenal drummer, and Stevie Wonder.
Yeah. Never got into that.
That is the pantheon for the moment.
Thank you very much to Gordon Raphael, who is going to now be there. Gordon's going to make his way around there. But there is a book here for sale. Please buy your book and you can get it signed. You're up for signing. You're up for signing?
Thank you.
You're up for signing. Buy the book,
you're up for selfies and signings.
Yeah.
I thought you thought, did you?
Buy a t-shirt. Buy the book.
And of course, this would not be possible. Let's do some thank yous first of all to Tony. Please do, if you take a picture, everybody tag Blitz Reek Record Shop on Instagram or Facebook. Please do spread the word. Tony's doing some great work. He has loads of fabulous, loads of great stuff here. So thank you, Tony. Yay. Thank you to Dale Boy, our cameraman for this evening. And thank you to Lucy for making this happen. Shout out to Liverpool Press. And of course, the man of the moment, Gordon Raphael, ladies and gentlemen, make some noise.